This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
This review comes as the government tests the water on Canadians' attitudes about how the government handles personal information. A poll of 1,000 Canadians commissioned by the Privy Council Office, obtained by Global News through a Freedom of Information request, found only one-third of respondents are confident the government shares information responsibly in order to respond to national security threats. When asked if they felt comfortable with the government getting greater information sharing powers, even if it affects their privacy rights, 50% of the respondents disagreed, while only 3 in 10 would be okay with it.
Bill C-2, the government's proposed lawful access legislation, has been the subject of several prior Law Bites episodes. They've covered warrantless disclosure of information as part of the new information demand power that can be found in Part 14 of the bill, as well as some of the new surveillance technology capability requirements that are contained in Part 15. Now, these remain major issues, but there is another element of the bill that deserves greater attention, particularly at this moment when the Canada-U.S. relationship is increasingly fraught. That issue involves mandated data sharing, with implications for Canada's international treaty obligations under both the Second Additional Protocol to the Budapest Convention, as well as the U.S. Cloud Act. Bill C-2 could be voted out of the House and sent to committee as soon as this week. Given that timing, I'm joined this week by Kate Robertson, a lawyer and senior research associate at the Citizen Lab in the Monk School at the University of Toronto. Kate wrote an extensive brief on these issues soon after the bill was introduced, and she joins me on the podcast to talk about a critical Bill C-2 concern that has thus far flown largely under the radar screen. Kate, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. So Bill C-2, which encompasses a wide range of things, but lawful access being an important part of it, could be voted out of the House and sent to committee for study very soon. Could be as soon as the week this drops, but it's certainly coming. This podcast and my blog have covered this bill from several angles, including the new information demand power in Part 14 that creates the warrantless disclosure of information provisions, as well as some of the surveillance technology capabilities that are found in Part 15. I think it's fair to say those remain significant concerns. But I asked if you'd be willing to come on the podcast because you wrote, I think, a really important analysis that focused on another element of the bill that I think deserves greater attention, especially at a moment when the Canada-U.S. relationship is fraught with some amount of tension. That focus was on mandated data sharing, with an emphasis on international treaty obligations that come out of something called the Second Additional Protocol to the Budapest Convention, as well as concerns with the U.S. Cloud Act. That's a mouthful, and hopefully people haven't sort of exited the podcast when they started hearing about all this legalese, because I think this stuff's important, and we're going to try to break it down on this podcast. Why don't we start, before we get into some of those, you know, sort of what got you concern, you sort of, in a sense, your spidey senses tingling with respect to data sharing when it came out of this? Was it something the government said as part of the bill, or perhaps was it something that the government wasn't saying when it came to this legislation and some of its provisions?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question, and I appreciate you and your effort to help unpack what I agree is a really important public interest implication of the legislation. Citizen Lab, as you know, is an interdisciplinary research lab that studies the intersection of law and technology and human rights. And myself and others have in recent years been studying cross-border surveillance practices and frameworks around the world, including most recently potential cross-border data sharing frameworks between foreign law enforcement authorities. And as you've alluded to, it's quite widely known that Bill C-2 is being tabled and has been tabled at a time where the Canadian government has entered into negotiations with the United States on matters of trade and security. And as a researcher in this space, I'm also following and aware that the legislation has been tabled at a time when there are actually two data sharing treaties or agreements that We know that the government of Canada has been considering, which would put Canada on a very different footing with the United States when it comes to data sharing obligations or laws. And we'll get into what those frameworks are, I think, over our time together. But what really is at stake in both of these treaties in slightly different ways is enabling law enforcement to have more direct access to data on the opposite side of the border while bypassing mutual assistance frameworks that already exist and have existed for a very long time, and reducing the role of courts in supervising surveillance orders. I ultimately published an analysis of Bill C-2, which situates the legislation in the context of our existing research that has identified really important constitutional and human rights problems with these frameworks. And partly what precipitated that publication is that while C-2 does not explicitly state that it's paving the way for new or expanded data sharing with the United States or other countries, the legislation does contain references to potential agreements or arrangements with the foreign state. But when this question about data sharing was put to Department of Justice officials in a technical briefing on Bill C-2, where certain stakeholders were invited, this was in early June of this year, Department of Justice officials acknowledged to the persons present at that briefing that the intent of certain provisions within Bill C-2 is to enable Canada to ratify one of these controversial new data sharing treaties. It's publicly known as the Second Additional Protocol. And the briefing acknowledged other cross-border cooperation tools were also foreseeable.
Okay. Well, I mean, so I mean, all of that I think would grab people's attention. The notion of foreign law enforcement agencies being able to access data from of C Canadian data without some of the typical sorts of oversights and agreements that are in place, as well as the fact that officials are acknowledging in a quasi-open way, the technical briefing was open to those invited, but it's certainly not something that the general public would typically pay attention to or even have access to, that in fact this has implications for these kinds of agreements. So why don't we unpack this a little bit, starting with the Budapest Convention, and then we can get into the Second Additional Protocol. So what is the Budapest Convention? Where does Canada stand on that? And then we can get into the protocol that has real implications here as well.
Right. So I guess this is just to set the backdrop because the Budapest Convention itself is not a new instrument. It's existed for decades now. Canada is a signatory and has ratified it, as has the United States. What it essentially does is it was intended to encourage countries around the world to harmonize their cybercrime laws so that when it comes to cooperation around the enforcement of cybercrime, there would be sort of a common lexicon of understanding and legal tools, including surveillance capabilities that domestic law enforcement agencies would be able to kind of cross-refer to if there was a sort of cross-border component to their investigation. And what's really captured the attention of human rights groups around the world is a new protocol to that convention that's really now been surfaced and negotiated, decades later, which is about data sharing obligations. And so that's really what's controversial and on the table now.
Okay, so this second additional protocol involving data sharing, where at what stage is it at? Is it's completed, but countries are in the process of considering whether to ratify, where does Canada stand? Where do some of the other countries stand on it?
So that's right. It has been negotiated and it's now open for countries to sign on to or not. Only two countries, I believe, to date, last time I checked, have actually ratified the treaty. So it is certainly at a quite nascent stage and it's not in force. Canada has signed on, and the last year, the Department of Justice announced that it was considering whether it would ratify the treaty, and if so, under what circumstances. So, as I alluded to earlier, it's a treaty that would it's really designed to bypass existing mutual cooperation frameworks that exist between countries and to expand the speed and volume of data sharing between law enforcement authorities in different countries around the world. It was originally put forward by the Council of Europe, so you do have quite a few countries in Europe and other parts of the world that are potential signatories, but it is open to other countries to sign on to. And in recent years, we are seeing more entrants to that framework. One of the key features is to enable direct access between law enforcement in one country and electronic service providers or other entities in another country to compel data without potentially the involvement of domestic courts on one side of the border or the other. Now, at the time that the Department of Justice announced that Canada was considering a potential ratification, at that time, myself and another colleague at the Citizen Lab submitted our research concerning the constitutional and human rights implications of the framework and recommended that Canada not ratify it. And you also have, we've also seen submissions from privacy commissioners, such as at the federal level in Ontario, regarding privacy concerns in the treaty as well.
Okay, so that we've seen some of that feedback and concerns expressed by Citizen Lab and some in the privacy community. Can you speak a bit more about what some of those concerns are? We'll talk a bit about how C2 comes into play in a moment, but what are some of those concerns? I mean, some of it's a bit obvious just from the way you describe what this seems to facilitate, but what are some of the things that you identified in your submission?
Yeah, so I think standing back and trying to sort of contextualize what it can be a very technical and procedural framework. One of the really problematic shifts we're seeing is how international human rights law standards are really being contested and are under threat in new ways through the treaty processes that have been ongoing in recent years, which really posed to reshape how data is being shared. What we're seeing in a variety of settings is that under the sort of umbrella of cooperation, and I'm using air quotes around that term because it's a term that can kind of cover quite a wide array of surveillance and data practices between law enforcement agencies. But we're seeing to an increasing extent that borders are actually being used in a way that is the opposite of what we want, which is you can have a framework that essentially exploits the presence of a border to the detriment of human rights, or to circumvent human rights standards that are enshrined in domestic law through cooperation with a perhaps more lax jurisdiction that does things differently. If the second additional protocol is adopted as a global standard, it would contribute to the elimination and diminishment of protections that are critical to mutual legal assistance treaties and norms. And as some have put it, it would leave potentially much of the world's population vulnerable to arbitrary and abusive data collection practices by domestic law enforcement agencies. And we also know that in the absence of robust human rights safeguards, foreign states are also able to leverage legal procedures in rights-respecting countries in order to engage in acts of transnational repression. And so, undoubtedly, what is precipitating some of these shifts is the need for more cooperation around transnational activity that comes within criminal laws of various states. But if, and often that framing has been taken up by law enforcement as a need for the equivalent or equal capability to move sort of seamlessly across borders in order to respond to these threats. But what's often left out of that framing is that we also need accompanying meaningful human rights safeguards to be equally meaningful in a cross-border setting. In the protocol, judicial authorization and other really core safeguards that are protected under international human rights law are largely treated as optional. And so They've in the explanatory report signaled that, many countries take differing approaches to some of these standards or safeguards, and it's almost treated as like a cultural difference. But we know that these technical safeguards around judicial oversight and search and seizure laws are not peripheral to human rights protections. They're actually the very content of international protections under treaties for privacy and in the search and seizure context. So if you have a group of countries coming together and signing a treaty that treats judicial authorization as optional, that's a direct threat to the content of international human rights law under international treaty law. And it's really signaling a problematic slide if Canada and other countries were to sign on. Really, the protocol expedites human rights abuses in trying to remove safeguards as the means of cooperation. And so we know that there are other even broader cooperation frameworks that could potentially be taken up as a fully global standard. And this treaty, although it's multilateral, in some ways it's regional, is the first kind of major instrument of its kind is positioned, unless countries like Canada push back, will set the standard for what we may see with kind of countries all around the world, including those who have problematic human rights records like Russia and others.
Okay. I mean, obviously that you've identified a whole series of pretty big red flags. Just to make sure that I'm understanding, the listeners are understanding. We start talking about how the border can effectively undermine rights, and then sort of layer in this notion of law and of judicial oversight becoming optional. Are you effectively suggesting that in a domestic context, over judicial oversight might be required, but once you start having disclosures that cut across the border with a request from a foreign service or a foreign entity, suddenly now the kind of rights that exist domestically may not exist in the same way because the disclosure is going outside of the country to some other foreign service, other foreign entity?
Right. So, it's a perfect question because it's really getting to the heart of the issue, which is that under the traditional model of mutual cooperation, you have two countries that have domestic surveillance powers as well as domestic human rights protections that are designed to kind of work almost in a siloed way, in a sense. And that has created some tension when it comes to access to data across borders. What the second additional protocol says is that for certain, even sensitive categories of data, like subscriber information or traffic data, you could have requests issued by law enforcement to even companies without the involvement of court, even courts on either side of the border. To disclose that data to the foreign law enforcement agency without any judicial supervision. It's treated as optional. Now, under traditional human rights treaties, that's intolerable and inconsistent with human rights. But in the protocol, that's treated as one of the options. Now, there are the potentials for states to opt in or opt out of certain levels of kind of direct access to foreign agencies. But certainly it as a whole, it represents a direct threat to the content of these safeguards. There have been other criticisms of how the treaty insufficiently carries other kinds of protections that we would expect around data protection standards and the like, and reducing the circumstances in which a country can object to the disclosure of data and under what circumstances. It's a whole bundle of, I should say, insufficiencies around these protections that are, complex for even practitioners in this space. But what has really caught the criticism of civil liberties groups and human rights organizations around the world is how it is driving down the need for really important and robust protections.
Okay, justifiably so, based on the way you've just described it. Okay, so we can see some of the concerns that arise in the context of the second additional protocol. How does Bill C2 come into play here? What are some of the provisions that are included within this draft bill that sparked your interest and that essentially led the department officials to suggest that, well, yeah, this could have implications for our ability to Canada's ability to implement or ratify that protocol?
Well, I should say that although we have received that information from the Department of Justice about the intent of the legislation, what we don't have is a explicit public statement that would spell out exactly what the government's intentions are with respect to this treaty. And we can talk about that perhaps as the conversation unfolds, because we've really pointed to the need for more transparency and how Parliament actually has some policies that do apply when it comes to the ratification of treaties, which, from what we're seeing, are not being followed here. So it's really left us in a situation of having to read between the lines. But what immediately jumps out as a connection to the second additional protocol is under Part 14 of Bill C2, which amends the Mutual Legal Assistance and Criminal Matters Act. Which is the act that exists to implement sort of mutual assistance protocols that have existed, as I've said, for some time. But we now have a new procedure for the enforcement of foreign production requests from Canadian technology companies, telecommunications companies, other kinds of electronic records holders. And what the provision says, it's in 22.07 is it creates a new pathway for foreign authorities to issue a demand for data, either transmission data or traffic data, as it's sometimes called, or subscriber information that's in Canada. And for that to be processed and enforced within Canada, you have a clear link here to Article 8 of the Second Additional Protocol, which also talks about the enforcement of foreign orders. Both schemes under the C2 and the 2AP, as I'll refer to it in shorthand, both say that production has to be made within 20 days for subscriber data or 45 days for traffic data. What is important and problematic about these provisions, among a number of concerns, you're really talking about the enforcement of orders potentially from law enforcement that are being issued without any supervision within the domestic courts of that country. So, for example, Serbia is a country that has ratified the treaty, and it has signaled that its law enforcement agencies will be the ones that have the authority to ask for data in a foreign country without the involvement of Serbian courts. The explanatory report to the protocol says that, only a brief recitation of the facts at issue in the investigation is required to make these demands. And certainly the exclusion of judicial oversight in the country where that agency exists increases the risk of either unfounded or insufficiently founded or politically motivated investigations that really shouldn't be processed. And it places a much greater burden on Canadian judges to kind of read between the lines to ensure that they're not authorizing inappropriate investigations from a foreign law enforcement agency. We do know that this protocol is likely to precipitate a really big uptick in the volume of requests that Canadian agencies would be expected to receive. And certainly, persons in Canada would be made more vulnerable to issues of transnational oppression as a result. The provisions reduce protection for both subscriber and traffic data by lowering the standard to a suspicion-based disclosure. And This is despite this our Supreme Court, as you know, that has said that these types of data are very sensitive and have significant privacy interests, which really should be signaling that that's not an appropriate threshold, particularly when you're speaking about warrantless law enforcement demands from a foreign state. But I would say that although these provisions are certainly signaling an intent to move forward with ratification of the treaty generally, it's not only what's in C2, but the fact of how the treaty itself would create new problems in the Canadian surveillance landscape. For example, the protocol also allows parties to establish in secret joint investigation agreements where enhanced cooperation is deemed to be of a certain utility, which could mean that you have, for example, agencies in Canada and the United States, for example, coming to such sort of off-books agreement under this framework. There's no explicit conditions limiting their scope, you can, as civil society organizations have pointed out, can see data transfers between agencies and jurisdictions under these frameworks through even the most intrusive means available. And all of that is done without public awareness or scrutiny. Article 14 itself of the protocol would prohibit Canada from requesting additional general data protection conditions for foreign requests for data, or from blocking data transfers due to the risk of human rights abuses. And so it's not only what C2 itself signals by way of ratification, but what the treaty itself as a whole will mean for the Canadian landscape.
Okay. I mean, the implications are huge, and it's notable when you start seeing parallel language included in a bill that mirrors a lot of what you see in the protocol, along with some of those comments. They may not have said anything to sort of directly at a ministerial level, but some of the signals are certainly there and flashing pretty loudly or brightly. That's only one part of the story, though. I mentioned off the top that it wasn't even just the second additional protocol. It was also the U.S. Cloud Act that may have some implications here as well, with the prospect of some conflict with Canadian law. Can you start us off by talking about what is the U.S. Cloud Act?
Sure. So the Cloud Act is legislation, and if you were to Google it, you'd probably get confused pretty quickly because it has a couple of different components to it. Sometimes it's referred to and known as legislation that under US law creates some important policy issues around sort of a conflict of law analysis, which is that the legislation says for US-based companies, if there are domestic orders issued against them in the US courts, they have an obligation to compel and respond, sorry, to respond to compelled requests, even if that data is based on its servers in a foreign state. So that's one context that the Cloud Act is often known for. But here, when I link the issues in C2 to the Cloud Act, I'm talking about other aspect of the Cloud Act, which is that it creates an opportunity and a negotiation framework for the United States to enter into a bilateral agreement with a foreign state around data sharing. And unlike the protocol, the second additional protocol, we're no longer talking about a multilateral agreement involving many states. We're really talking about coming to terms of an agreement with both Canada and the United States alone, although the United States already has some of these agreements in place with other countries. It's broader in scope, though, than the second additional protocol in terms of the types of data and surveillance orders that would be commonly applicable in the scope of a potential agreement, and really has a sweeping reach over electronic data held in Canada to a very broad degree. And it's understood to kind of facilitate anything from access to subscriber data to even real-time surveillance like wiretaps or even potentially hacking of devices. We've also alerted the public to our understanding that in the negotiations, it may be considered that this would extend to not just law enforcement agencies, but national security agencies as well. So, not just collection of information for criminal law enforcement. And what the essential or kind of most basic characteristic of these agreements is that they exclude the courts. So let's assume we're talking, for example, about the FBI in the United States. They have an interest in data that's located, let's say, at a telecommunication company based in Canada or a bank like TD Bank. They would have an interest in accessing that data. What the cloud agreement is anticipated to mean is that they would be able to get authorization through their US-based laws and serve that order directly on the Canadian entity without having any Canadian court supervision at all. And the implication of the agreement is that Canada would remove any roadblocks to having that data sent to the United States' authorities that may exist right now, for example, under privacy legislation.
Okay. At a time when there's a lot of talk about data localization and trying to keep Canadian data in Canada, this sounds like there's the prospect at the same time of agreements that envision the data moving to the United States under whatever is agreed to under these kinds of agreements, but regardless of where it's located, so that the notion that you're protecting your data by having it localized in Canada is a bit illusory if you've got an underlying agreement that could see it transferred across borders in any event. It does raise the question, all this raises the question of, well, what's the interface with Bill C2? Are there provisions in there that seem to anticipate or lay the foundation for some sort of potential data sharing agreement with the United States as envisioned by the Cloud Act, as you just described?
Right. And yeah, I mean, just to respond to your initial comment there, I mean, that's quite an astute and correct observation that, there is public discussion around, what's often referred to as digital sovereignty issues in Canada and how various legal frameworks in the United States might implicate or affect the ability of, the provinces like Quebec or companies to protect data under certain circumstances. What we're really talking about in the Cloud Act agreement is ceding a much more traditional form of sovereignty itself, which is Canada's sovereignty over enforcement jurisdiction in its territory. And so by coming to this agreement, we would be actually ceding quite literally a form of our sovereignty to the enforcement jurisdiction of the United States, which would, as you point out, make moot anything that happens by way of infrastructure or localization and that kind of thing, which is something that my research hasn't really touched upon. Now, in terms of, I think that there's a whole kind of thicket or minefield of constitutional human rights issues that would be implicated if Canada were to enter into this type of agreement with the United States. We share a very long border and a long history as neighbors, but there are really meaningful differences between the two countries when it comes to the constitutional privacy frameworks, and they've existed for decades. And I think the easiest or most important way to describe that is by describing the United States Supreme Court's following of what's called referred to as a third party doctrine. And it basically says that if you share information with a third party, like even a telecommunication company, that you are essentially ceding your privacy rights in respect of that information. So the general understanding is that under the US's framework, under the Fourth Amendment, the law enforcement no lo longer needs to comply with Fourth Amendment protections when information is captured by this doctrine. Now, For the astute listeners, they'll say, well, how the heck do you have a framework like that when, our lives are full of digital third parties? Our phones are full of third party apps and companies that hold our data, where we certainly have no meaningful expectation that our privacy has been given up by using those services. And really, these digital services are essential to our day-to-day lives. And even as long ago as the 90s, the Supreme Court said, well, actually, I don't think this is going to work long term. People really need the security of having judicial oversight. And that I think has led to really different, and I would say more technologically resilient framework under Section 8 of the Charter. And but it's created a number of situations where, and I'm getting to how this gets back to C2 momentarily, in some circumstances, you can have warrantless surveillance practices of the United States that would not be constitutional in Canada. And as recently as the Supreme Court's decision in Bickovitz, which has been discussed on this podcast and elsewhere, the courts reiterated that we take a distinct approach from the United States on these issues. So for folks who are following the issues at stake, when negotiations under the Cloud Act originally began between the two countries, it was anticipated that negotiators would be faced with the challenge of what to do when Canada's constitution provides broader protection or judicial oversight obligations to the United States. Earlier this year, myself and Cynthia Ku at Citizen Lab described it that negotiators are facing a minefield of incompatibilities and contradictions between Canada's constitutional and human rights framework. Now, Part 14 of Bill C-2, it has been rightly commented upon for raising really a slew of new constitutional problems that, unfortunately, are not the first to. This isn't the first occasion in which we've had these sort of circular debates around lawful access issues. But in this particular moment, what we're alert to is that these very same laws that are being criticized as likely unconstitutional, or certainly face constitutional challenges in Canadian courts, they would reform Canada's surveillance powers in multiple ways that would make our framework look a lot more like the US surveillance model. This could include warrantless or less protected access to subscriber data, reduced protections for both subscriber and traffic data, aligning powers that would seize both of those types of data simultaneously in ways that really map on to US laws. We have a provision in C2 that stipulates that warrantless data disclosures are lawful when they're provided voluntarily from entities like electronic service providers. That's a concept that really comes straight from the third-party doctrine that Canada has rejected. And it's likely that these proposed reforms are factoring potentially heavily in negotiations surrounding this potential agreement. So, if negotiators were to conclude an agreement that requires US authorities to issue, let's say, surveillance orders that are at least as protective as those in Canadian law, the adverse consequences of C2 would be even more profoundly detrimental to existing protections in Canada because it would really create this sort of double-barreled effect where we're not only seeing a reduction in protection under Canada's own terms and constitutional standards, but where thresholds would also be lowered for US law enforcement authorities accessing data in Canada.
Okay, I mean, there's a lot there, and if I'm hearing this correctly, essentially, it boils down to the notion that Canada has had, especially through some of the decisions that we've had in recent years, Spencer, Bykovitz, and others, a heightened level of protection for certain kind of information. The concern is C2 either eliminates or lowers that. I'd query as to what will happen when this bill, if remains unchanged, goes to the court and. It seems to me the court's been pretty clear cut about where it stands on these issues. So it strikes me that it's going to be really vulnerable to a challenge. But leaving that aside, based on just the pure language, it lowers that threshold, which it seems like opens the door to it facilitates an agreement under the Cloud Act for data sharing with the United States. And so you end up with lower thresholds in terms of accessing this data, both in Canada and then This gets exacerbated by way of a Cloud Act agreement where US gains access to it under these lower thresholds as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's a perfectly correct way to summarize the situation that we're in. I mean, even if I think it's a big if, but even if C2 is not factoring into negotiations directly, the possibility alone of a Cloud Act agreement is an extraordinarily large loose end to have dangling over the policy debate that parliamentarians and the public are re being required to consider in C2, because the implications are quite profound, if I can put it that way. But as obviously, the government of Canada should not be entering into treaties or agreements with foreign states that are not compatible with constitutional standards. But saying that out loud, it certainly would be a diplomatic embarrassment or mess, quite frankly, if constitutional court challenges that are forecast for this legislation, if it were to pass, would essentially disrupt a closed-door agreement that struck with the Americans on the premises of this legislation.
Yeah, no, I mean, it would be quite remarkable to see legislation that is vulnerable both to being struck down domestically on constitutional grounds, given some of the previous Supreme Court decisions, and then it has that follow-on effect that you've just described. I mean, the implications are pretty big. This is frankly quite very troubling to hear about sort of that broader perspective that, people might be looking at C2 and be familiar even with years of debate over lawful access, but not fully appreciate that there are other moving parts here that are implicated by what's taking place. I mentioned off the top that C2 is likely to be sent to committee shortly, could happen any week now. If you're invited, what would you say to committee, or put another way, what do you think needs to happen to this part of Bill C2?
Well, I think that, to put it this way, hundreds of organizations have spoken up and out calling for this bill to be scratched and reconsidered. And I understand why. I agree with that overall assessment. There's a number of issues that really what we've been speaking to really doesn't even get into, and that's one of the, deep problems with an omnibus approach to legislating is that you wind up taking the oxygen out of really important public interest issues that deserve attention in their own right. But the issues here on data sharing agreements that I've been pointing to really only reinforce that conclusion. Ultimately, in publishing our research in the context of data sharing agreements that links to C2, we've really pointed to the need for greater transparency around what is happening and to move forward with implementing legislation in advance of that transparency is really putting the cart before the horse. At the time that Prime Minister Harper was in government, we had a policy that was put forward that has been adopted where Parliament has the need for greater involvement at the ratification stage of treaties. And I think that it's quite critical for parliamentarians to point to the need for compliance with this policy to be essentially corrected right now, because what we're seeing, certainly by the terms of the technical briefing that we received, we are having legislation move forward without that policy being complied with. It's not only that the policy states that these treaties need to be tabled in Parliament so that parliamentarians are alerted to the issue. The policy also requires an explanatory report that would set out a whole host of information that's critical to public discourse on this that right now is leaving us with more questions than answers. And as much as I'm alerting to alerting the public to these linkages, I'm very far from the only voice or expertise that needs to be brought to bear when this type of consideration is made. Whether you're talking about industry concerns, civil society perspectives, areas of provincial responsibility, Indigenous data sovereignty. These are really a wide array of considerations that really need to have transparency so that they can give proper information and expertise and advice to government at this time. I also, if I were to be speaking with parliamentarians about what kinds of considerations should be made here and why we really need to see C2, let's say, left to the side for really some really priority issues to take precedence. You have had privacy commissioners raise the need for Privacy Act reform, for example, as a really critical safeguard that Canada is left vulnerable within if it were to take on data sharing obligations with quite antiquated privacy laws controlling the government. We've been alerted to the need for Canada to become a signatory of Convention 108 Plus, which is a data sharing, or sorry, a data protection treaty that I really don't know why we would consider entering into fraught and risky data sharing treaties without having first taken on that principled commitment. But more broadly, I would, sometimes these policy debates can become a little bit entrenched into the sort of discourse and bubble that they come from. And I think it's really important to recognize what we're not hearing about when we have proposals like this being brought forward, which is really an absence of evidence or data about the existing context. We haven't really had any information put forward about, what is the existing problems and the extent of those problems with our mutual assistance frameworks that we already have. In an audit by the Office of the Inspector General in the United States, they found that in the United States, the main issue is staffing shortages. So there's a really troubling, I think, propensity to sometimes look for law reform, and what we really need are resources to facilitate existing safeguards. We don't know, for example, in Canada, which countries are making requests for Canadian data and how often, and vice versa. I think that in, if we were to say, if we were to sort of take the analogy to a domestic law enforcement investigation, you would never have the government say that, well, we things are taking too long, so we need to delete judicial authorization requirements. It's just not a, it's not a reasonable policy solution to what is essentially a resource problem. And so it's really problematic to be having a really fraught policy decision being made without proper data and information about the actual nature of the problem we're experiencing. I also think I would raise that we should be thinking about this in the context of Canada's larger interests and in geopolitical circumstances. We know that the government is alerted to the need to kind of closen Canada's ties with the EU and reduce our dependency on the US as a trading partner. You've had in your on your podcast series, Colin Bennett, who's talked about the really difficult process that's been underway between the EU and the US on how US surveillance models are really threatening commercial data sharing relationships, which would be a huge problem for trade and commerce if and right now, with some of the changes that we've seen implemented by the White House, I think that the status of that framework is on a knife's edge. To move towards the US's model would take us further away from adequacy under European standards, which really should be prioritized at a time like this. And then I think lastly, I would really encourage parliamentarians and the public to be mindful that Canada doesn't have a perfect track record when it comes to information sharing. We've had some really tragic examples of even information sharing gone awry with the United States alone. And if we move forward in a way that doesn't prioritize the human rights risks at stake, I think that we're really setting ourselves up for even more painful, if not more prominent and prolific examples of that in the future.
Okay. I think you've got your opening statement about ready to go if you do get an invitation. Thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you for the work that you're doing and really what is, I think, a wake-up call, a red alert, so to speak, around, I think, an underappreciated and under-discussed aspect of C2 and activities that are moving ahead, which have enormous implications from a privacy perspective in Canada. And it is hard to pay close attention to that as part of an omnibus bill, to be sure, and as part of a bill that doesn't even advertise or really focus on the privacy implications. And when you do, it is hard to know where to turn to first. But you've done a great job of unpacking why these issues are so important. And so thank you so much for the work that you've been doing and for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo Lebron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose Lebron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.